OU Israel presents.
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. And this show is for Shabbat Parshat Matos Maseh. I should say Matot Maseh, but we say Matos Maseh in the old country. Recording and first broadcast is Yom Chamishi, Thursday, Chaf Dalid Tammuz, the 24th day of the month of Tammuz, 5769, July 16th, mid-July, towards the end of Tammuz. The Shabbat is a double parsha of Matot Maseh. We bench Rosh Chodesh this Shabbat, ushering in and announcing the month of Av, which we'll talk about, which is next Wednesday. Wednesday, July 22nd, is the first day of the month of Av, the one day of Rosh Chodesh Av. Before we continue, let's say Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai, Adonai Shema V'Koli, Tehiyena Oznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai, Im Avonot Tishmor Yoh Adonai Miya Amod, Ki Imacha Hasalicha L'Ma'an Tivarei, Ki Viti Adonai Kivita Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hocholti, Nafshi l'Adonai, mishomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael, mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael, hanetunim batzara uvashivya, haomidim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem, v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha umeafela laora, ומשיבוד לגאולה השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב ונאמר אמן. Interesting comment I saw in a book about Rosh Chodesh Av. It seems there were some communities in Europe in previous generations who did not want to announce the coming of the month of Av. And of course, our announcement of the month on the Shabbat before Rosh Chodesh includes a very hopeful prayer for a good month coming up with a good life and all of those kind of things. But the communities felt that since the Mishnah says Mishenichnas Av Mima'atin Besimcha, as the month of Av enters, we diminish in joy, that it would not be appropriate to anticipate its coming with an announcement. If it has to be there, let it be there. The mainstream practice, which I think is universal today, is definitely to announce the coming of the month because of the blessing which we give the month. And if there is a month that needs blessing more than Of, I don't know which it is. Along similar lines of the feeling of the month, even though it says Mishenichnas Av Mima'atin Besimcha, that we diminish in joy when Av enters, that diminished joy basically takes effect from the beginning of the month until the 10th of the month. The 9th, of course, is Tisha B'Av, the mournful fast day. But, according to our tradition, the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, continued to burn from the 9th throughout the day of the 10th, and therefore the 10th is a mournful day as well. Common practice is to consider midday, halachic noon, to be the end of the mournful period. This year, because that will be on a Friday, there are further restrictions, relaxation of restrictions, I should say, but we'll go over those next week, Emir Tz Hashem. The fact of the matter is, the month of Av will be announced as Rosh Chodesh Menachem Av, will be Biyom Revi'i, will be on the following Wednesday, and the use of the additional part of the name Menachem Av, a month of comfort, really kicks in the second and third of the month, meaning from the 10th, 11th to the end of the month. And in fact, the common custom is to refer to the month as just of, from the beginning until after Tisha B'Av, until after Yud B'Av, and then to call the month Menachem Av. It's a psychological kind of thing. There are different customs, but it all points to the fact that it is a dark month, but only the first third. Once Tisha B'Av comes and goes, there is a feeling of comfort in the air because the light at the end of the tunnel of exile, so to speak, is seen. Still following my music policy of the 3 weeks, we will have a sad song a cappella, a melancholy song, maybe it's not sad. It's from the albums that I described last week. I have two albums, one which is called Music for the 3 Weeks, the other is called Himeshkachech Yerushalayim. This song is called Al Kein Tzion, and after we hear it, we will try to take some kind of overview of Matot and Maaseh, combined forming the longest Torah reading of our calendar, a fear that many a bar mitzvah boy has if they happen to have their bar mitzvah Shabbat on Matot Maaseh. I imagine some families actually postpone it a couple of weeks, not only to get it out of the 3 weeks and 9 days, but to give the boy a little bit more comfortable sedra to study. Be that as it may, it's a long sedra. It's a double. It's the most combined of all the pairs that often combine and many times don't. And we'll talk about that after Al Kein Tzion.
tziyoyim b'martivke. Al kein tziyoyim b'martivke. V'rusholoyim, v'rusholoyim, titen koilo. V'rusholoyim, v'rusholoyim, titen koilo.
Ish ki yidor neder lashem, o hishava shivua leesor isor al nafsho, lo yachel devaro, kechol hayotze mipiv ya'ase. The second verse in the beginning of Parshat Matot tells us the following. Moshe is transmitting one of the mitzvot to the leaders of the people and to the people, and he says this is what God has commanded. A person who takes a pledge, makes a vow, takes an oath to forbid something to himself or whatever, lo yachel devaro. He may not profane his word, but rather, kechol hayotze mipiv ya'aseh. He must do all that comes out of his mouth. This verse, and one other source in the Torah, is the basis of permission to take a neder, to make a pledge, to take a vow, to swear, and the requirement to fulfill what you do, pledge, or swear to. And the serious prohibition of someone who violates his own pledge, promise, oath, etc. That, in a nutshell, in a single verse, is the one side of the laws of vows. This is followed in the Torah by 14 verses that introduce us to a concept known as Hafarat Nedarim, and it is our first glimpse at the other side of the coin. Notwithstanding that a person who makes a vow must keep it, there are two circumstances which the Torah discusses where a person makes an oath, takes a vow, and someone else nullifies it. The two cases are a father and a daughter, the daughter being already the age of mitzvot, 12, but not yet 12 and a half, during that first half year after the girl reaches the age of mitzvot, she has a status called na'ara, not yet viewed as a halachic full woman, which will come after 12 and a half, but no longer viewed as a child. And a girl, a na'ara, who takes a vow, on the day that her father hears of it, he has the halachic authority, the Torah's authority, to cancel it by his declaration. That's the story. The girl says she vows never to wear perfume. Bad example. She vows to pierce her ears with five holes. And the father hears of this vow, and he nullifies it. It has no binding power on the girl. A father has the authority to nullify a vow made by a daughter, Na'ara. The other example, with a little bit more restrictions, is a husband's power to nullify a vow of his wife. In this case, the halakha says, we're talking only about a vow that would affect him. If a woman, and that's why I said before it wasn't a good example, here it is. If a woman swears off of perfume, or of bathing, or of cooking, or of relations in bed, the husband, on the day that he hears such a vow, has the authority to state that it is null and void, and it is so null and void. In either case, if a father hears of a neder of his daughter, or a husband of his wife, and they let the day go by without the declaration of nullification, it becomes a binding oath which they no longer have the ability to cancel. Let's summarize till now. We have a Torah requirement that a person who takes a pledge, makes a vow, or swears something must fulfill his word, may not profane his word. We have, I call that the one side of the issue. The other side of the issue is father-daughter, husband-wife, under certain circumstances, have the authority to nullify such a vow. Further detail of the other side of the oath-vow coin is not available in the written word of the Torah. It belongs to the oral Torah, which we believe is no less God-given than the written word, but you will not find it in the written word. In fact, there is a Mishnah in Masechet Chagiga which uses Hatarat Nidarim, nullification of vows, not in the case of the father, daughter, husband, wife, but in general, which I'll describe in a moment, as an example of that body of halacha, body of Jewish law, which floats in the air and has no specific text to anchor it to the written word. The Mishnah says at the end, it does not matter how much text a mitzvah has or not in the oral word, in the written word. What matters is it is all part of Torah, both the written word and the oral law together make up our complete Torah. As a side point, although it's not really a side point, when the world took the Bible from the Jewish people and insisted that it be translated into their languages, they took only part of the Torah. Anybody that has a King James version of the Bible, or even a Koran Tanakh, or the best Tanakh that there is, and he holds it in his hand, he is holding part of Torah, not the entirety of Torah. The entirety of Torah includes the oral law and tradition as codified in the Mishnah and the Gemara, sometimes called the Talmud, and the written word in the Torah is not able to be understood properly in most cases without the oral law. I state that as an unequivocal fact. It happens to be a strong component of Jewish belief, to the point that it is fact. In this case of vows, it makes a very, very important point, because usually that which is elucidated in the oral law has concrete text in the written word as its foundation. If the Torah says, Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo, you shall not cook a goat in its mother's milk, and the oral law teaches us that it includes the meat and milk of all domesticated kosher animals, and perhaps, I say perhaps to hedge, the meat of the non-domesticated kosher mammals as well, and that it includes a prohibition of cooking, as well as which the Torah mentions, and also of eating, and also of deriving benefit from mixtures that were cooked together, that's part of the oral law, but that part of the oral law has something in the written word to anchor it to, namely the three times the verse appears, Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo. Hatarat nedarim, which I have not yet described, floats in the air and does not even have a written word to attach to, and yet it is an integral part of Torah with equal status to the written word. Now, let me illustrate with first explaining what Hatarat Nedarim is, and then with connecting it to the other side of its coin. But before we get to that, we will be taking a break. Of course, as I say many times, if you're listening to this on the radio stream of Arutz 7, there is actually going to be a break for news and announcements. If you're listening to this archived or on OU Radio where it is archived, then there won't be a break, and it will sound strange when I say in a moment, we'll be right back. But that's what I intend to say anyway. With the topic of Hatarat Nedarim, we will be right back.
You're listening to
Torah Tidbits Audio.
Rest your eyes.
We're back and in the middle of the topic of Nidarim, vows, and vows goes with everything else related to it, specifically Hatarat Nidarim. Let's use my favorite example. A person gets on the scale, is alarmed by how much weight he's put on lately, knows that his weakness is chocolate chip cookies, and he takes a vow not to eat a chocolate chip cookie from now on. That's a binding vow, and it's a very serious thing. And for such a person, if he were to eat a chocolate chip cookie, it would be equivalent to eating pork, which is forbidden to eat. Maybe even a little more serious, because he created the prohibition on himself and then went and violated it. And this includes intentional violation. It includes inadvertent violation. He was at a party someplace and he absent-mindedly reached to a plate of chocolate chip cookies and popped one in his mouth while he's talking to someone. Violation, prohibition, sin. Okay, but it's binding. Now the guy, couple of years down the line with a sensible diet and a regimen of exercise, has not only cut back on his weight, but he is at a very enviable weight and status of health, and an occasional chocolate chip cookie would not harm him at all. And he doesn't need any more not to eat chocolate chip cookies, but he is still bound by a vow that he took. And it bothers him, and he thinks about it. And here I'm on a little dangerous ground. Let's assume that he asks a halachic question and receives a psak, a halachic rabbinic opinion, that this kind of vow he may annul. It's getting complicated, I don't mean it to be, but let's continue. He goes before a Beit Din, a panel of three, or a rabbinic expert in the laws of vows, and he presents an opening to be able to nullify the vow. He said, had I realized at the time, had I thought it out, and realized the ramifications of my swearing off of chocolate chip cookies forever, I never would have said what I did then. I definitely would have modified it to say that if my weight drops below a certain thing, I should be allowed to eat it. But I was alarmed, I was upset, and that's how it came out. And therefore I ask to be unbound from that vow. Again, remember that if it doesn't really work with chocolate chip cookie vow, it works with other things. The panel of three, or the rabbinic expert, has the authority to nullify this person's vow. And then it's as if he never said anything. Now that's fine, except for one thing that seems to bother some people. But that's okay too, and we'll see that. Nowhere in the Torah does it say that you could do such a thing. So what that your weight came back to normal? So what that your wife baked chocolate chip cookies and will be upset if you don't have one? Or your daughter? It doesn't matter. You made a vow. The Torah requires you not to profane your word and to keep what came out of your mouth. Where is the basis on which you can unbind yourself from a vow? The answer is, it's part of the oral law, Torah law, not less than had it been written in the Torah, that basically is the other side of the coin. Meaning, and this I am interpreting this way based on what I've learned, that the vows that the Torah wants you to uphold are the ones where your mouth and your mind and your heart were in total accord with each other, thought out, not in the heat of a moment, not in anger and not in disgust and not in any other thing, but it was clear to yourself that what you said is what you meant, is what you meant to mean, and that's the kind of neder that's binding. But when you say something, and it in essence is a foolish outburst, then the Torah is not going to hold you to it, provided you go through the process called Hatarat Nedarim. I'll go you one step further. There are situations where our sages said, that's not even a vow. It might sound like a vow or an oath, but it isn't, because that's how people talk and that's not what they mean. My favorite example of that would be, you go into a store, you pick up a book. How much is the book? 100 shekel. 100 shekel? I swear I wouldn't pay more than 70. And the storekeeper said, I give you a discount, but I swear I won't take less than 90. Question, can you buy the book for 80 shekel? If you buy the book for 80 shekel, then you are violating your oath not to pay more than 70. The storekeeper is violating his oath not to take less than 90 for the book. So how can you possibly buy it for 80? Comes the Mishnah to teach us that that's how people talk in bargaining, and the term there is not an oath that comes from thinking out and feeling and stating. It comes from a style of emphasizing that you really want it for less than 100, and he wants it for more than 70. And you can accept a compromise of 80, which is not a violation of an oath on either party's part, because that's not an oath. When a mother says, if you do not eat every string bean on your plate, I promise you, you will not watch television for a month. That's not an oath. And it doesn't even require hatarat nidarim. Hatarat nidarim are the serious kind of things, which are not exaggerations and not meant to encourage something to be done. Let's say here in Israel, a person says, I'm going to go to the Kotel once a month, and realizes that it's not an easy thing to keep. Didn't realize that a spell of rainy weather made it very difficult to go. An obligation out of town made it impossible to come back. Does that kind of oath remain binding? Or is there an opening to nullify it? And the answer is, if you appear before that panel of three, or you appear before a rabbinic expert in vows, and you explain to him that when you said it, you meant that you would like to go to the Kotel at least once a month, at least once a week, whatever I said, and you didn't mean that if you were in the hospital or something like that, that you would have an ambulance take you to the Kotel in order to keep your pledge. It wasn't that kind of pledge. It wasn't meant to be that way. And on that basis, you can be released from such a vow because it was saying something that's more than a person has in his heart. I don't know if I've explained this well, but I'm not going to say anything more about it now. There are other topics in Matot Masei to cover. I would like to play, at this point, one more track from those albums. This one with a phrase from the Book of Eicha, which we read on Tisha B'Av, but it is an upbeat kind of statement to make. The words are Chasdei Hashem ki lo tamnu, ki lo chalu rachamav. Translation: Hashem's kindness surely has not ended, nor are his mercies exhausted. And that's a very hopeful thing, especially on a day like Tisha B'Av, and that is the flavor of this song, a cappella, voice only, no musical instrumentation, totally appropriate for the 3 weeks. Thank you. I'm changing topics now abruptly because the bulk of the rest of Matot and of Maaseh deals with the impending entry into the land of Israel. And there's some very significant messages for us. You have first the whole business of the two tribes, which ended up as 2.5 tribes, who requested permission to remain on the east side of the Jordan River in the territory that Israel had already conquered at this point, because they found it very fertile ground for their grazing of their flocks. And Moshe's first reaction was one of great anger and upset because of the sense that here we go again, 40 years, almost 40 years earlier, the Meraglim discouraged the people from entering the land, and they were severely punished for it. And here we have 2.5 tribes, or two tribes, Reuven and Gad, who are potentially going to discourage people from going into the land of Israel. This is not the way you're supposed to behave. The bottom line was, though, that this land would become part of Eretz Yisrael, and they were given permission to prepare to come back to that land after first going across with their brethren to fight and conquer the land of Canaan, which is, we'll call it, on the west side of the Jordan River, which is Israel, the land of Israel, Eretz Yisrael per se. So you have that idea, and you have that shivering echo of the people who say, let me stay. It's not at all the same, but it sort of jars you when you put it into today's perspective, of the people who find more lucrative and comfortable lives, at least they think they do, in certain places outside of the land of Israel. And in essence, they're asking for permission. Again, it's not the same, but it sort of. They're asking permission to remain there rather than to go where God wants us to go, which is into the land of Israel. So, you know, that's a sort of message that comes, I believe, from Matot. In Maaseh, we have a review of the travelogue of the people from the time they left Egypt until they arrived to the border of the land of Israel, and we have certain rules set down for them to take into Eretz Israel with them, the setting up of cities of refuge, the apportioning of cities, assigning of cities for the Levium, the dividing up and settling of the land. And in fact, we find in Parshat Maaseh the source, or one of the sources, of the mitzvah to dwell in the land of Israel. And even though Rambam and Sefer HaChinuch do not number the mitzvah of living in Israel among the 613, Ramban Nachmanides does, and there are arguments as to why, discussions, reasons given as to why Rambam and Chinuch do not, but it does not make it less of a mitzvah. Perhaps it makes it even more of a mitzvah. But I don't digress, but I'm getting ahead of myself. We're talking now about the verses God said to Moshe in Arvot Moav, with the plains of Moav on the Jordan River, saying, speak to the people of Israel and tell them that you are crossing the Jordan to Eretz Canaan. That's a command. V'horashtem et kol yoshevei ha'aretz mipneichem. You will conquer the land from all of its inhabitants and destroy their idolatry. V'horashtem et ha'aretz v'yishavtem bah. You will acquire the land and dwell in it. Kilachem natati et ha'aretz l'reshet otah. Because I, says God, have given you this land to settle it. Ramban, in elaborating on the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, living in Eretz Yisrael, says the mitzvah applies in all times, including today, his today as well as our today, that included in this mitzvah is that God gave us the land and not other peoples, and therefore it is forbidden for us to give parts of the land of Eretz Yisrael to others, whether it be a sovereign state or a demilitarized state. None of that is permitted according to the Torah. To have non-Jews living in the land of Israel is permitted. But there's a proviso that the people who live here cooperate and accept the authority of the Jewish people on the land of Israel. And this is not a weird thing to expect. Every other country has it. You want to live in a country, you have to give your allegiance to the country that you choose to live in. Otherwise, don't go there, or don't be there. That's another story. Included in the mitzvah of dwelling in the land of Israel is also the prohibition of doing what you're supposed to do to the land of Israel any place else. Which means, if a Jew is living in Brooklyn, in northern New Jersey, in Muncie, Borough Park, Teaneck, Golders Green in London, I don't care where you choose, wonderful, thriving Jewish communities. If you recognize that you are strangers in a strange land, you're okay. I don't mean completely okay, because you should be here anyway, but at least you're not violating this extra dimension. When you have conquered, so to speak, and settled yourself in to another land, you are, in essence, mocking what God says in the Torah, V'horashtem et ha'aretz v'yishavtem bah. It is the land of Israel that you're supposed to be dwelling in. Ki lachem natati et ha'aretz l'reshet otah. Because I gave you that land to settle. I did not give you Teaneck, New Jersey. I did not give you Borough Park. And I did not give you Muncie for that purpose. I exiled you to those places and every place else around the world. And if you feel as if you are in exile and you pine to come back to Eretz Yisrael, and you plan to come back to Eretz Yisrael, then you're in consonance with what it says here in the Torah. If you dig yourself in to a Jewish community outside the land of Israel, and you settle there, and put down your roots, and see your future there, you are in essence in violation of this part of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. It is not a simple thing. It is a very serious issue, and it is very much part of the message of Matot Maseh. As usual, I've run out of time, I think, so let me wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, Lehishtameach.